Well, thank you, Dean Huddleston, and you don't need to apologize about my being a stand-in. That's not a new experience for me or for anyone else who was in radio. The last time I was doing a stand-in assignment was for Kate Smith, as I recall. And one of the advantages of being a stand-in is that at least you get a big audience when you begin to talk, because the people who are listening thought they were really going to hear someone worth listening to. I not only have you at that advantage, but you're also what they call a captive audience. That is, you're shut in this hall. There's a snowstorm outside. I don't know whether you're ever going to get home. You might as well make the best of this afternoon here. Anyway, my purpose here is not to tell you what you ought to think about the world today, the world situation. The most I hope to be able to do is to outline how I think you might try to approach it. You may disagree entirely with the conclusions that I reach. I hope, though, that you may agree with the approach that I try to take toward these problems. One model I would take, a man who I would commend highly to anyone around here to read, is Walter Lippmann. I don't always agree with Mr. Lippmann's conclusions, but if I on the radio am able to give the same sort of rational approach to world politics and world affairs that Lippmann is in his column, I should be more than satisfied. As I say, it's not a question of the opinions and the recommendations. It's more the point of view. Now, I think that anyone today feels there are two things that are hitting us all in the face, especially right now: taxes and the draft. We need both taxes and the draft to balance the strength of Russia in the world today. We may never have to fight the Russians, but any weakness on our part would invite something a good deal worse than war. That would be defeat and a loss of freedom. Everyone, I think, is agreed on those points. And I think there's pretty much general agreement, too, on the question of being strong enough to balance the greater strength that Russia now possesses. I think there's agreement also on the need for balancing our budget, for paying as we go. Now, President Truman said today at his news conference that Congress is just going to have to take that tax bill he'd given them and like it. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But there are a couple of facts about the tax bill that are pretty tough to get around. For example, only 1/6 of the tax bill that the president has presented, only 1/6 of it, that's less than 20 cents in every dollar, goes into non-military spending. 1/6 goes to veterans, and to the service on the national debt, and 4/6, 2/3, 66 cents in every dollar, goes to arming ourselves and our friends and sending aid abroad, so that they may be able to cut the budget to some extent on that part that goes into non-military expenses. But remember, that's less than 20 cents in the dollar that's going into that. The rest of it is all going into essential military expenditures, veteran payments, and debt service, so there's not a great deal of fat that can be taken off. Most of that is necessary muscle. And with the spending at that rate, at that clip, there is, of course, this terrific danger of inflation. I don't need to spell all that out to you. I've heard some of these talks that have been broadcast the last few days about inflation and the need for keeping the currency from getting out of control and holding some lid on prices. You all know that. I don't need to go into the need for it. But it might be well to just recall a couple of lessons of history, what inflation has done to countries. After the First World War, certain industrialists in Germany decided it would be a good idea to inflate the German currency out of existence. And the mark just went down till it was worth nothing at all. That wiped out your whole middle class. It gave a few men great control and power over German industry. It wiped out the whole national debt. All the war bonds, all the war holdings became valueless. And as a result of the German inflation, there was the middle class eliminated. And from that, right directly, just as sure as the day follows night, just immediately as a result of that came Hitler riding into power on this dispossessed middle class. And you know where Hitler ended up with the Germans. The French at the end of the First World War had an inflation too. Not such a big one, but it was pretty serious. An inflation of 80%. Their currency was worth only 20 cents on the dollar by the time they got through. They were not willing to pay taxes. They were not willing to submit themselves to control. Their middle class wasn't ruined to the extent the German middle class was, but you know what happened to France as a result of its failure, its refusal to meet up to the necessities that the expense of the First World War imposed. The result of that was utter defeat and ruin in the Second World War. Great Britain, on the other hand, after the First World War, remained solvent. The British taxed themselves, taxed till it hurt, and then some. They were taxing themselves in the years between the wars more than we are called upon to tax ourselves today. The British, you will note, unlike the Germans and the French, survived the Second World War. They came through. Their difficulties today are not due to the high taxes. Their difficulties today are due to the disappearance of the whole empire, to a process of it's far greater than anything that's happening here and quite different from anything that's happening here. But we can learn from Great Britain, from the experience there, as against the experience in France and Germany, teaches very clearly what happens to a country that does not make the necessary sacrifices in the way of taxes and controls in time. The British did it and survived. The French and Germans did not do it, and look what happened to them. Well, now, why then do we need to build up this strength? Why is it so important to spend all this money to make ourselves strong as against the Russians? Build up our armed forces, build up the allied countries, the democracies in Western Europe. Why is it so necessary? Well, now there are two opinions on the present condition, the present state of affairs between ourselves and the Russians. There may be that both of them are right, or there may be some truth in each. Mr. Churchill holds that fear of the atomic bomb is the one thing that is holding the Russians back. That only the knowledge that we have the atomic bomb is preventing the Russians from marching across Western Europe and right up to the English Channel. And he therefore says we should seek a showdown with them at a very early date in order to use the advantage of the atomic bomb while we still have that edge. Well, that may be true. I don't know. But I can see more reason to believe, as Mr. Churchill himself said, 5 years ago, when he spoke at Fulton, Missouri, I see more reason to agree with an earlier decision, an earlier judgment of Mr. Churchill's, which was that Russia wants the fruits of victory without having to fight a war. I think that is the real essence of the present Cold War, the present deadlock, the present tension with the Russians, that they want to get the victory, the fruits of victory, without the fight that would lead up to the victory. The Russians could, there's no question about it, the military men will agree to a man. The Russians could sweep Europe now anytime, could have swept Europe anytime during the past few years. If Stalin were Hitler, which he is not, if Stalin were counting only on military strength, military aggression, military attack, as the Germans did when they set out on their plan to conquer the world, surely he would have struck last summer. There never could have been a more favorable time from the military standpoint than last summer for the Russians to have moved across Western Europe. We had much less preparation than we have now. We had nothing in Western Europe to stop the Russians. They could have gone through with no opposition whatsoever. They didn't do it. Now, why didn't they do it? I think there's a pretty clear answer to that. A somewhat complicated answer, but I think it's intelligent and I think it holds up all the way through. In the first place, as I said, Russia is not Germany. We are rather misled on this whole situation with the Russians by pretending that we are again facing another Hitler and that it's just the same thing as Hitler, and if we treat Stalin the way we treated Hitler, why we'll come out the same way, that you just handle the two of them the same. Actually, the methods and approach of Stalin and Hitler are quite different. The German approach always has been an approach of military conquest and military force. Their position on the continent of Europe, their whole history, has forced them into that kind of tactics. The Russian position, even long before communism, has been quite a different one. Being a great land mass, people who are very difficult to defeat in war, impossible to defeat in war, but not densely populated, not very highly advanced and developed technical industry and the rest of it, spread out all over the place. They have not ever been so successful in wars in the West against the more advanced countries of Western Europe. Then in addition, under the communist rule, under the communist system, they have had a very definite and distinct approach of their own to world affairs. And their approach, their idea of world conquest, of world domination, which they want just as much as the Germans ever did, their idea is to get that not by military force, but to get it by subversion, by revolution, by fifth column activities, by the support of native communists inside different countries all over the world. They have been trained and taught to believe that steadily for the past 30 years. Their own people have been weaned on just one belief, the belief that the capitalist democracies are going to collapse of their own weight, are going to run into internal crises, and that these crises are going to lead the capitalist democracies eventually to attack the Soviet Union. The Russians have had that drummed into their heads for the past 30 years. And I believe that the Russian leaders, unlike some of the fascist leaders, believe their own propaganda. When Ciano, Mussolini's son-in-law, came back from a visit to Hitler, he related to Mussolini with a laugh why the man believes his own atrocity stories. That was very funny and very comical from the point of view of the cynical fascist. But from the point of view of a man like Stalin and the other leaders of the Soviet Union, they have been very thoroughly indoctrinated, much more so than any Nazi or fascist was, with a Marxist, Leninist, communist point of view, which tells them that the capitalist world is going to crack of its own weight, and they are going to win the world by virtue of revolution in these countries. And that if war comes, the war will come from the capitalists attacking them. Now, with this state of mind, it is, of course, quite possible that the Russians will do the very things that would lead us to attack them. The question, therefore, is whether they will, of their own accord, feeling that we are attacking or about to attack, whether they will march across Europe on their own decision. Just today, in this morning's Chicago Daily News, I noticed two items that rather bear out the contention that I've argued right along on this whole Russian proposition. Lloyd's of London is now offering 50-to-1 insurance rates. They'll bet you 50-to-1 against war in 1951. William Stoneman, the Paris correspondent of the Chicago Daily News, cables from Paris today that American diplomats from the Iron Curtain countries, where they have a very good opportunity to observe what's happening, what's going on there, these American diplomats all report that they do not think that the Russians are planning any aggressive war this year or any other year in the near future. They expect the trouble to come, if trouble does come, from some bad piece of judgment on the part of the United States, that we might do something such as get too deeply involved in China that would then invite a Russian attack. I think the Russian aim is quite different from an aim of driving an army across Western Europe. I think their aim right now, and maybe for quite a long time to come, is to split the North Atlantic Pact countries and to split the United Nations, to divide and distribute the present front that exists and is being formed against them. What the Russians hope for and what all their propaganda, all their maneuvering seems to be headed toward is to face Europe with a threat of attack with a sufficient strength greater than ours so that the governments of France, of Italy, of Germany, even of England, would withdraw from the North Atlantic Pact, would not vote against the Russians in the United Nations, would set up what you might call neutralist governments, governments that would stay neutral in the event of any trouble between the Russians and ourselves. Insofar as war is concerned, I believe what the Russians are looking to is 5 or 10 or more years ahead. They hope to be able to neutralize Western Europe, to set up governments like the one that used to be in Czechoslovakia, in Hungary, in these satellite countries before the Russians took complete control, set up merely friendly governments with perhaps one or two communists or communist sympathizers in them, set up these governments and then conduct a long-range war with the United States in a period of 5 or 10 years. It is entirely possible that the Russians will then have enough atomic bombs, guided missiles, submarines, and the rest, to be able to use these guided missiles and use these submarines to launch atomic attacks or threaten atomic attacks upon us. Even though we might have 10 times as many atomic bombs as the Russians, 5 times as many as we have today, whatever the figures may be, still, the Russians always could get something through. One of the flaws in the line of argument pursued by Senator Taft and President Hoover is that by arming to the teeth, we can assure ourselves complete protection from attack. There's no such thing. We can't get complete protection from attack by just building up an enormous Air Force, an enormous Navy. We can't do it by building up an enormous army either, because there isn't any complete protection. There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. The point is that in the course of a few years, the Russians get their atomic weapons developed to a certain point. We are then, and we are now, far more vulnerable to atomic attack than the Russians are. They also would be in position, perhaps, to get much closer to the targets, through submarines particularly, much closer to the targets than we could get to the Russian targets, with all of Europe lying in between. So I'm not attempting to present just a Pollyanna picture here. But when I talk about the possibility of war, that I think is the much more likely possibility at some future time. Now look at it again, take it and look at it from another point of view, turn it around and look at it in another way, at this problem of Western Europe, and what would happen if the Russians were to attack today. There are certain weaknesses in Russia to which I don't think that we have paid sufficient attention, to which we don't give sufficient weight. When the Russian armies moved into Eastern Europe, when they invaded Hungary, Romania, and as far as Vienna, and reaching into Czechoslovakia and Prague and the rest, when the troops in these Russian armies saw these capitals of the cities of Eastern Europe beaten up as they were, backward as they were, and in bad shape as they were, those Russian troops, when they came back, were so impressed, were so surprised, so staggered by what they thought was the luxury of Europe,